This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Peter Edelman, resigned in protest from the Clinton administration in September, 3 weeks after President Clinton signed the welfare reform bill. Edelman was the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation at the Department of Health and Human Services. When he resigned, all he would say in public was that he had worked for over 30 years to reduce poverty, and in his opinion, the welfare bill moved in the opposite direction. But now he's written an article called "The Worst Thing Bill Clinton Has Done," explaining why he thinks the new welfare system is even more awful than the one we had. It's the cover story of the current Atlantic Monthly. Resigning from the administration meant leaving an old friend. Edelman and his wife, Marion Wright Edelman, who founded the Children's Defense Fund, are longtime friends of the Clintons. I asked Peter Edelman why he's waited till now to speak out.
I didn't want to speak out during President Clinton's reelection campaign because I didn't want to affect his chances for reelection. I really did want to see him reelected. I have some serious reservations, as the piece indicates, but I believe that Bob Dole would have been a lot worse for the country, particularly coupled with a Republican Congress. After the election was over, I did start speaking out in terms of going around the country and responding to invitations, but it just took this long to write this piece and to get it placed and to edit it and everything that goes with that. So I was conscious of the timing in the sense that I wanted it out before most of the legislatures had done their work on welfare this year, for whatever good that would do. And so the timing does work on that account.
Now, you say you didn't want to hurt the president's chances for reelection. Did you think, gee, maybe I shouldn't resign at all? Maybe this will bring negative attention and that will hurt his reelection?
Well, yeah, I had to balance that. And we're talking about Mary Jo Bain here as well, who resigned at the same time as Assistant Secretary for Families and Children. We both felt very, very strongly about this law. We felt that it went to something extremely fundamental, not just a disagreement about some policy or another, but very, very fundamental. And we just thought that that statement ought to be made. But the way in which we resigned was to make an email statement to our own staffs, and then that, not surprisingly, got out. And then we didn't make any more comments. We didn't take any interviews. And so when you added all of that together, it made the statement, but without becoming a kind of a secondary and lasting controversy all on its own.
What are your biggest differences with the welfare bill that President Clinton signed?
The worst single thing, if you had to sum it up in one sentence, is that no state has any statutory, any federal responsibility to do anything for anyone. And it is literally true under this that they don't have to run a cash program if they don't want to. They, as Jason DePauw wrote in the New York Times, they can do real welfare reform if they can find the money, because it will cost more than the federal money, or they can give people a bus ticket out of town. And what's been done here is to take the entitlement. Now, that's become a very nasty word, but that really means two things. One is that when an individual comes to a welfare office under the old system anywhere in the country, if they complied with the conditions that were set forth, and that meant cooperating about work, they could get help for themselves and their children. And indeed, there were procedural protections. They had to get that help within 30 days. If there was a way in which they felt they were being pushed around, they had to be given a hearing. That's all been wiped away here. There's no procedural protection here. There's no requirement of a response with reasonable promptness. Also, the word entitlement means that there was a federal share in the funding of that assistance, regardless of how many people had come and applied that year. So if there was a bad recession, you didn't run out of money. That's been wiped away as well. You have a capped amount of money, $16.4 billion a year, which includes the responsibility to do job training and job placement and all of that with no new money. You have all of that instead of having the assured federal money. And when a big recession hits, there's a little money in here for recessions. That's going to be a serious problem. Or when, even more than that, when a particular part of a state or a particular state has recession. Those are the heart of what's wrong here.
Do you think that President Clinton believed in the welfare reform bill when he signed it?
Oh, golly, I suspect that he probably had worked himself around to believing in it, yes, thinking maybe that the alternatives, given how ugly our politics has gotten, might be worse if he let it, quote-unquote, fester longer. Maybe he thought, because he's a governor, had been a governor of a small state, that he seems never to have met a governor he didn't like, even a Republican one. Maybe he had more faith than I do in the way the politics would work out at the state level. And I, by the way, think that a lot of states will do interesting things and will do the best they can. But we're already seeing some proposals from various governors around the country that support my idea that we ought to be worried. So I think he had probably worked himself around to believing that over a period of time that things will get better with this bill rather than worse. I think he's terribly wrong.
Give us a sense of some of the things that were happening behind the scenes when he was deciding whether to sign the bill or not.
Well, yes. If we're talking about the weeks just before he made that decision, or even days just before he made that decision, he had a solid phalanx of advisors. The majority of his advisors, both substantive and political, were urging him to veto the bill. It's not surprising that he was getting substantive advice from people like Donna Shalala and Bob Reich and Henry Cisneros, but also his Secretary of the Treasury was telling him to veto the bill. And even more interesting is he was getting political advice that he could veto the bill and that it would actually help him politically.
That seems counterintuitive. What was the argument?
The argument was, and I'm talking about people like Harold Ickes and Leon Panetta and George Stephanopoulos, the argument was, if you veto this bill, you have the bully pulpit, and you can say, they've sent me three unacceptable bills, and this bill is specifically unacceptable because of what it does to legal immigrants, about supplemental security income and about food stamps, because of what it does to food stamps in other ways, and because of the way in which it does not protect children after the five-year time limit. There were specific things that he could have pointed to, and he simply could have gotten the benefit of being a man of principle, a man who stands up for what he believes is right, and actually not only these people believed, these are professional political people, not only not hurt himself, but help himself.
I imagine there were also people in the administration politically arguing the other side, that if he didn't sign it, the Republican Congress would use this against him very effectively and say, look, here's the man who won the presidency,
sure,
in part because he campaigned to end welfare as,
sure,
we know it, and look, he's not even allowing this welfare reform bill,
sure,
to happen.
Sure. You would have had a debate of my three strikes and you're out versus their three strikes and you're out, if you will. Three bills vetoed. My understanding is the vice president was urging him to sign the bill. That's certainly has to be counted. And of course, his political advisor at the time, Dick Morris, and then other more junior people in the White House, and maybe one or two others. But
wait, Dick Morris was on which side?
Oh, wanted him to sign the bill.
Wanted him to sign the bill.
So saw it as very central. But, you know, the real question about all of that is, because I can't sit here, you and I can't sit here and know what would have happened, and I have no doubt that Bob Dole, lacking issues as he did, would have talked about it every day the way he did talk about drug policy, which wasn't a terribly salient issue politically. It's a very important issue, but it wasn't terribly salient politically. Sure, that would have happened. We have the point about the political advice he got from others, but the more important point is that this didn't just boil up in the week before he had to make this decision. He seems to have decided way back in 1995, when he was in a very, very weak position politically, that this was a salient area for him to prove that he was really a person of the center, that he was not a so-called old liberal.
Did you know before the president signed the bill that if he signed it, you would resign?
I did not. The critical events for me were in the 48 hours after he said he would sign the bill. At the end of July, you remember, there was a very dramatic day when there was a meeting with all those people that we talked about before who were there in the White House debating in front of him whether he should sign or veto. And then at the end of the meeting, he announced he was going to sign it, and they went out and announced that publicly. And I must say my initial reaction was, besides being absolutely horrified, was that I could stay and implement it, that I'd been on leave from the university for 4 years, and it was kind of getting to be time to go back and resume my law teaching, and that I could do that in an orderly way. And it just came over me in a very, from my gut, I would have to say, over a period of about 48 hours, that I couldn't live with that. And I finally went to Secretary Shalala and I said, I can't do this. And she said she understood, that she wished I wouldn't resign, but she completely understood.
Had you ever done anything like that before?
No. In fact, somebody reminded me, I'd been a candidate to be dean of our law school a few years ago, and somebody reminded me that they asked me whether I was the sort of person who resigned over over issues of disagreement with, in that case, the president of the university or whatever it would be. And I said, no, I wasn't really somebody who did that sort of thing. I've always regarded myself, I do regard myself as a practical person, and that we need to stay in the game, and which I am doing here, and accomplish what we can at the same time that we continue to have our eye on knowing where we need to be going. So that you get up in the morning and you do what you can that day, but knowing where ultimately the kind of definitions of justice and so on lie. And so I have to say I surprised myself a little bit, but I think it fits with a larger effort that now has to happen for people on the outside all over the country who care about these things, to get involved and to make this thing work in the best way possible, and to document if it's not working so that we can take that back to the Congress and the state legislatures and get some change as soon as possible.
My guest is Peter Edelman. He wrote the cover story in this month's Atlantic magazine called The Worst Thing Bill Clinton Has Done. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Edelman. After President Clinton signed the welfare reform bill, Edelman resigned in protest from his position as Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services. One irony here is that you and your wife, Marion Wright Edelman, who is the founder of the Children's Defense Fund, are long-term friends of Bill and Hillary Clinton and saw eye to eye on many issues pertaining to children. And now you have this really big difference with them. Do you feel that they have changed politically? And were you surprised of being in the position of resigning from the presidential administration of such an old friend?
A lot of things have happened that are surprising. I never would have predicted that the Republicans would take over the Congress in 1994, which is very key to understanding what's happened here. I don't agree with how the president has responded to that in some very key ways. Although I think he handled the budget negotiations 95-96 very well and kind of regained his footing and was helped tremendously by the stumbling of Newt Gingrich and others, the complaint from Gingrich that he'd been made to go down the back steps of the plane and shutting down the government and all of that. I guess when it came down to it, I said to myself, you have to separate out friendships from issues. And, you know, maybe there's some gray area of something that's not the hugest thing where you say, well, he did something I disagree with. And so, of course, I'm working for him. It's not even a question of being a friend or not. You don't just go out and disagree publicly about everything. This is something that broke a 60-year consensus. Now, we've had a lot of debate about it, but this is something where what happened was outside of any framework that somebody going to work for him on those issues had any reason to expect would happen. And, you know, that just kind of throws everything up for grabs. So I did that. It's just, you know, I have certainly would hope that any friendship that I have is one that would continue. I hope that the one doesn't have to do with the other. But the main thing here is this issue. That is the main thing.
Have you undergone any significant changes in your views on welfare since the 1960s when you started working on welfare issues?
Yes, I certainly have. I was in the 1960s, did not believe that it was necessary to use any form of stick, any form of compulsion to get welfare recipients to go to work. I believed that if you simply change the economic incentives so that it was sufficiently better off to be working, that most people who were in a position to work would go out and work, and you'd be left with welfare as a kind of residual disability category, functional disability category. For a variety of reasons, we've never been in a position to do that in its kind of pure form. It would cost a fair amount of money to both have really adequate welfare benefits and have the returns from work be even better than that. And so compulsion creeps into the conversation, and I must say that more broadly, I'm much clearer in my mind about the element of personal responsibility that really is seriously in this equation.
Describe what you mean.
I think that we did not say sufficiently, we might have meant it implicitly 30 years ago, that all of us in the society have to take responsibility for ourselves. People who have a difficult time need some help in getting around to doing that, perhaps. But in terms of saying that there is a kind of a notion in how a democratic society ought to operate, that we all have a responsibility to give something back to the community, and that we have a personal responsibility to support our children, to be good parents, and to be working if it's at all possible, those are all themes that have real meaning.
So how would you write that into a welfare bill now?
I think that's where the notion of some compulsion would come into it. And it seems to me if you're taking people who, let's say, have, because we haven't done the prevention adequately or have nonetheless slipped through the cracks and they've been on welfare for a long period of time, or in any case, we just want their stay to be as short as possible, you have to invest in training and education. This is along with the compulsion. You have to invest in support for wages if the wages are sufficiently low that they're not getting out of poverty, which we have in the minimum wage and we have in the earned income tax credit, but not adequately. You have to invest in child care. You have to invest in health care. And for people who've been on for a long time, you really have to invest in a transition period which is going to last a while because people often don't make it in that first job. So those are the things that would go into a sensible kind of welfare reform. That costs money. Although, actually, as we succeed in getting people into the economy, if jobs are available and we don't have to, and by the way, I would also invest as necessary in transitional public jobs to help people make it.
I have another question about your relationship with President Clinton, mm-hmm. a longtime friend, and you resigned, you left his administration in protest after he signed the welfare bill. A couple of years ago, he had promised you a federal judicial position,
mm-hmm.
and he withdrew that after he took some heat because you were considered too liberal by conservatives and conservatives were pressuring him. How did you react to that? Do you think he should have persisted with that?
No. Yes, of course, I'd like to be a federal judge, but in terms of the politics, the Democrats lost control of the Congress in 1994, and, timing is everything in life. He had decided to name me to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit during the fall of 1994, and before there was ever a chance to actually send the nomination to Capitol Hill, the control of the Senate and House were lost. And the Republicans were looking around for ways in which they could do some specific payback for their judgment that Judge Bork was unfairly denied his seat on the Supreme Court of the United States. And there I was as somebody who had written some articles that looked a little suspicious and had been involved in different kinds of causes and so on. And besides that, I was here. I was, you know, billed as a friend of the president and the first lady, and my wife, with her ties to the first lady. So indeed, my relationships with Ted Kennedy, and it was, I don't know, we talk about twofers in some fields. It was like a fourfer or a fivefer to go after me. And so the politics of that would have been tough. But, you know, if I'm such a terrible radical or something, it was interesting that Senator Hatch, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, was willing to get me confirmed for a district court judgeship, or try to anyway, if the president would nominate me for that. It just got too close to, that part got too close to election year politics, and I've always thought it's just a question of not being in the right place at the right time.
Peter Edelman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure to be here with you. Thank you so much.
Dr. Peter Edelman is the former Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services. His article, "The Worst Thing Bill Clinton Has Done," is the cover story of the current Atlantic Monthly. Edelman is a professor of law at Georgetown University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hot flashes, sleepless nights, and diminished libido are some of the changes that may accompany the onset of menopause. One remedy is hormone replacement therapy. But there's a lot of confusing information about the benefits and risks of prescription hormones. Dr. Susan Love lays out and evaluates some of the information in her new book, Dr. Susan Love's Hormone Book. Dr. Love is a women's health advocate, breast surgeon, and author of the popular book, Dr. Susan Love's Breast Book. She teaches at UCLA and directs the Santa Barbara Breast Cancer Institute. She's starting an independent think tank to study women's health issues. The hot flashes, etc., begin in what's known as perimenopause, the phase of fluctuating hormones which signals the onset of menopause.
You know, the perimenopause is really sort of puberty in reverse. With puberty, your hormones are gearing up. They're all over the place. You have acne and mood swings and sleep all the time and are obnoxious. And then everything evens out after 3 or 4 years. And you cruise along with sort of standard hormones. And then as you get close to menopause, the same thing happens in reverse. Your hormones are all over the place. Very often the estrogen is very high 1 month, and then it can be low another month. And those variations in hormones which again cause symptoms. Acne, mood swings. This time, instead of sleeping all the time, you don't sleep at all. But I think that's because you're only allowed a certain amount of sleep in your life. You know, and if you've used it up at puberty, you can't have it at perimenopause. But just like in puberty, though, after 2 to 3 years, those symptoms even out, and then you're on a new level, and your body continues, your ovaries continue to produce hormones well into your 80s, albeit at a lower level. So that symptomatic period, some women feel they really need to do something to get through it. And then I think taking hormones briefly for 3 to 4 years and tapering off is probably fine. What I'm particularly concerned about is this notion that we should all be on hormones for the rest of our lives to prevent all kinds of things. And that's what really bothers me.
Well, now, what bothers you about that? And just to back up a second, a lot of research shows now that women can prevent osteoporosis or heart disease with estrogen. And there's new research showing that estrogen can help prevent Alzheimer's disease and slow down memory loss.
Well, actually, that data is not very solid, and I think you have to look at it very carefully. We don't have any prospective, that means looking forward, randomized controlled studies on looking at estrogen or estrogen and progesterone, and those are really the gold standard. What we have are observational studies, and what that means is you go into, for example, a retirement village, and you look at the women who have been put on estrogen, and you compare them to the women who haven't. And indeed, the women who have been put on estrogen have less heart disease. But they also are a higher socioeconomic level, more likely to go to the doctor. That's how they got on hormones in the first place. More likely to treat their high blood pressure, their high cholesterol, to exercise, to eat a good diet, than the women who are not on hormones. So it may well be that it's not that the hormones make you healthy, but rather that healthy women take hormones. And until we have a study that has the same number of couch potatoes in each group, we're not going to know whether it's the hormones or whether it's selection. So that study was started a couple of years ago, and it'll be done in the year 2008. But as of now, we actually don't have proof that estrogen prevents heart disease.
What about osteoporosis? Are you comfortable with that scientific evidence?
Well, osteoporosis is a little different. We can show that estrogen will prevent bone loss and therefore reduce fractures. But again, it's a little bit tricky because most women are not going to have osteoporosis. It's not automatic. And the average age of fractures is in the 80s. And so the question is, should you be taking a drug for 30 years from 50 on to prevent something that may happen in your 80s? And it's a drug that it's a drug. It's not a vitamin, and it has side effects. The most worrisome being that there is an increase in breast cancer.
Now, breast cancer is your specialty. I would imagine that you, of all people, would be particularly concerned about the possibility of increasing risk of breast cancer.
Absolutely. And the other problem with breast cancer is that it happens earlier than the heart disease and the osteoporosis, or even the Alzheimer's. So you're saying, on the one hand, people will say, well, 1 out of 3 women will get heart disease and only 1 out of 8 get breast cancer, so heart disease trumps and you should take hormones. But the average age of the heart attack is 78, 79. The average age of breast cancer is mid-60s. So it really isn't, you can't just compare and contrast, and you may be trading off getting breast cancer in your 60s for, you know, allegedly not getting a hip fracture in your 80s. And I think women haven't really been given the full information in order to make these decisions.
Well, what does the research say about the link between estrogen and breast cancer?
Well, we know almost every risk factor for breast cancer has to do with estrogen and progesterone. You know, the younger you are with your first period, the older you are with menopause, when you have your first pregnancy. And indeed, the studies for postmenopausal hormones, not surprisingly, also show an increased risk. It's not huge. It's about 30% overall, and about 70% for women who have taken them at least 10 years. Now, these are also based on observational studies, I should say, so they have the same problems that the heart disease data does, only in reverse. Women who are high risk for breast cancer tend not to be put on hormones. So therefore, the women that we're seeing this 30% and 70% increased risk on are probably the low-risk women. And my guess is that we're probably underestimating the breast cancer risk and overestimating the benefits.
When you say that there was a 70% greater risk of breast cancer for women who took estrogen, I just want to clarify what that means. It doesn't mean that women are 70 times more likely to get breast
cancer. Right. No, you're absolutely right. That's what we call a relative risk, which means if you take a woman who is not on hormones and you say her risk is 1, then the risk of the woman who is on hormones is 1.7. It's not quite double. Double would be if the risk went to 2, and so 1.7, it's 70%.
To put it another way, if 100 women of 1,000 are likely to get breast cancer, the increased risk with estrogen would be 170 out of 1,000.
That's right. That's right. 70 additional women would get it. That's exactly right. So it's not, you know, it's not a huge risk. It's not like smoking and lung cancer, for example, but it's real.
My guest is Dr. Susan Love, author of Dr. Susan Love's hormone book. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Susan Love. She's a breast surgeon and women's health advocate and author of a new book about menopause and hormones. Dr. Love, in your hormone book, you have a whole table of perimenopausal and menopausal symptoms. This list of symptoms runs the entire page, and I will just read some of them. Menstrual irregularity, hot flashes, dry vagina, insomnia and or weird dreams, sensory disturbances, funny sensations in the head, lower back pain, Waking in the early hours of the morning, onset of new allergies or sensitivities, fluctuations in sexual desire and sexual response, annoying itching of the vulva, sudden bouts of bloat, chills or periods of extreme warmth, indigestions, flatulence, gas pains, rogue chin whiskers, overnight appearance of long, fine facial hairs, bouts of rapid heartbeat, crying for no reason. I think I'm halfway down the list now.
I mean,
who wouldn't want to take something to stop all that?
But that is potential or possible symptoms. I don't know any woman that has all of those symptoms. It's more to show that there's a whole variety of different things that people can experience. Most women, in fact, don't experience any of them. But very often a woman will be in the time of perimenopause, will have some funny symptom, and the doctor will just poo-poo it, particularly if she's still menstruating, and say, oh, you know, it's all in your head, when really it's somehow related to perimenopause. So I think it's important to realize that a lot of the studies were done in doctor's offices, and the women who were in the doctor's offices had symptoms. That's why they were there. But if you do a community study where you just go door to door and do questionnaires, the vast majority of women have no symptoms that they feel need any treatment whatsoever.
I want to ask you about quality of life issues with estrogen at menopause or perimenopause. A lot of doctors and women who have taken estrogen feel that estrogen helps enhance their sexual lives. That some people say it helps maintain the quality of your skin, fewer wrinkles, more moist skin, and helps keep your memory intact. What do you think about the quality of life issues?
Well, I think it's very variable. There are women where taking it really makes them feel a lot better, and there are other women where it makes them feel horrible. And I think there's a lot of variation in that. In fact, if you look at the package insert for Premarin, which is the biggest most commonly used estrogen in this country, it states it will not help your skin. There is no data to support that. It doesn't help depression. There's no data to support that. The memory stuff is provocative but not really proven. One of the problems with some of the data is it's really based on both animal studies and also human studies on women who have had hysterectomies and had their ovaries out. And they equate menopause with having your ovaries out. And it's based on this myth that with menopause, our ovaries just sort of shrivel up and die and stop working, which in some ways, I guess, is the metaphor for what happens to postmenopausal women. We shrivel up and die and become unproductive. But in fact, that's not what happens. And so women who go through a natural menopause are still producing estrogen, albeit at a lower level, testosterone, androstenedione, and they're chugging along with hormones, as opposed to women who've had their ovaries out who really don't have that background level of hormones.
I'm hearing that you're not confident in a lot of the studies that have come out, and so that you don't feel confident about making a decision.
Well, I think the data is preliminary, and I think some of it is quite provocative, and it'll be interesting to see if it pans out. But I don't think we have hard enough data to tell a generation of women to take these drugs for the rest of their lives. And I think women need to realize that this is still a big experiment, and we don't know what the long-term results are going to be. And they still can make the decision. I actually don't care if a woman decides to take hormones or not, but I care very much that she has the information, the accurate information about what we know and what we don't know, so that she can make as informed a decision as possible.
So if I'm hearing you right, you're very concerned about the long-term effects and you don't feel like we have enough conclusive scientific research about that, but you feel more confident about using estrogen in the short term, a few years, 2, 3, 4 years.
Yeah, I think the short-term use for symptoms is fine, and then I think what you do is you want to taper off slowly. One of the problems that's happened in the past is people don't tell that to women, and if you stop abruptly, then you'll feel symptoms again. But if you taper off over 6 to 9 months, then actually after 2 or 3 years, your symptoms are usually pretty much gone.
Do you have any alternative remedies to recommend for the symptoms of the onset of menopause, the hot flashes, the sleepless nights?
Well, there are a lot of alternative remedies. Starting, I really think what you need to do for this kind of thing, which is not a disease but is really a normal part of life, is you want to look at the least harmful ways to deal with it first and then move down to the more dangerous ones. So the least harmful are exercise, which exercising will decrease hot flashes, diet. Particularly the in thing now is to increase the amount of soy in your diet. It's very interesting that there is no word in Japanese for hot flash. They don't have them. And if you ask them in a million different ways, they just don't have hot flashes. And currently the thinking is that has to do with the amount of soy in their diet. So the in thing now is to eat more tofu and non-fat soy milk and flaxseed and soy nuts, and by doing that, soy has a plant estrogen, which can help reduce hot flashes as well as cholesterol and bone, improve bone density, and maybe even prevent breast cancer.
Has there been any actual research done on soy?
Oh, yeah. There's been a lot of research done on soy.
And like, say you start gorging on soy in your 30s or 40s or 50s, is that going to be a little too late to...
Well, I think part of the breast cancer benefit may have to do with how much soy you ate around puberty.
No, probably not a lot for breast
people. Right, which is not helpful. However, the cholesterol data, which was reported in the New England Journal last year, is on current eating of soy. You can reduce your cholesterol. Also, there's other evidence that it can help, in animal evidence in heart disease, and that it decreases bone loss for osteoporosis. So... there is data on that. And I think that's, you know, eating a lot of soy is not going to have any harmful consequences and may well have some benefits. It also, I should point out, prevents prostate cancer. So the whole family can do it.
Here's something you hear a lot now. Women are living longer than they ever did historically. And hormones can help extend the most pleasurable part of their lives, the extended better quality of life, including more sexual activity, memory, better sleep, and so on. So since science has come up with this way to extend that part of your life, why not? Because the whole life cycle is just different. A lot of women are living into their 80s now, which never happened before.
Well, that's not entirely true. I mean, I think that
I think the number of people,
is
definitely higher.
80s. Yeah. But there were always women who lived into their 80s. People will say, oh, well, the average life expectancy, you know, a couple of centuries ago was 35, which is true. But that's because an average life expectancy adds everything up and divides, you know, by the number. Most of the people died in infancy. So if you add up and divide, you get 35. But in fact, many women lived into menopause, and there are anthropologists who actually have done research on what is the evolutionary advantage of menopause. You know, why, as a species, is it programmed in? And they find that those hunter-gatherer societies that have a group of non-fertile older women do better, because those are the women who are the teachers and the daycare workers and the... And they're much better gatherers, because it's very hard to gather with a kid hanging on each leg. So, in fact, the menopause is important, and it's normal, and it's programmed in. And many women have always lived after menopause.
You're a doctor who is starting a women's medical think tank.
That's right.
And I want to say I think there's a lot of controversy within the women's health community about taking hormones at menopause, and I don't want to give the impression that there's unanimity there, because there isn't. And I'd like you to discuss a little bit from your perspective where the divisions are among other feminist doctors.
Well, I think that if you frame menopause as a normal, natural event, and if you look on aging as normal and natural, then the notion that you need to take drugs to somehow change it becomes uncomfortable. You know, when you look at it, we're taking birth control pills from puberty on, and then by the time you want to get pregnant, you may well need fertility drugs, and then You go on postmenopausal hormones till you die. I mean, what are we saying about women's bodies when we're changing them all the time by these extra hormones? By the same token, you've got the position that that we don't have to suffer, and that some women are suffering a lot from symptoms of menopause, and here there are drugs that can take away the suffering, and we shouldn't suffer. And I think the parallel is sort of like childbirth. We went from the age where childbirth was done where you were completely sedated and didn't even know you'd had a baby until 2 days later, to this notion that, you have to do everything naturally, and, natural childbirth is the only way to go, and somehow you're bad and evil if you took any drugs at all. And I think the answer in childbirth was somewhere in between, that there are some women who are fine doing it naturally. There are some women who have a lot of problems and do need drugs. And I think menopause is exactly the same.
My guest is Dr. Susan Love. Her new book is about menopause and hormones. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.